This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location today with visiting poet at Goucher College, Jane Hirschfield. Here's Jane.
Theology. If the flies did not hurry themselves to the window, they'd still die somewhere. Other creatures choose the other dimension, to slip into a thicket, swim into the shaded, undercut part of the stream. My dog would make her tennis ball disappear into just such a hollow, pushing it under the water with both paws, then dig for it furiously, wildly, until it popped up again. A game or a theology, I couldn't tell. The flies might well prefer the dawn-ribboned mouth of a trout, its crisp and speed, if they could get there, though they are not in truth that kind of fly, and preference is not given often in these matters. A border collie's preference is to do anything entirely, with the whole attention. This Simone Weil called prayer. And almost always her prayers were successful. The tennis ball could be summoned again to the surface. When a friend's new pound dog, diagnosed distempered, doctored for weeks, crawled under the porch to die, my friend crawled after, pulled her out, said, "No," as if to live were just a simple matter of training. The coy dog, startled, obeyed. Now trots out to greet my car when I come to visit. Only a firefly's evening blinking outside the window, this miraculous story. But everyone hurries to believe it.
That is the voice of Jane Hirschfield. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Jane is preeminent poet in America, one of America's greatest women poets, and she's the author of 5 books, and additional to those is a brand new book called After, and those are the poems we're going to hear today. She was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and winner of the Poetry Center Award, the California Book Award, fellowships from the American Academy of Poets, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim, the Rockefeller, and we will hear many, many others. How long was this book in the making?
Roughly 5 and a half years. My last book, Given Sugar, Given Salt, came out in 2001, and of course there's always a little bit of overlap time. So a very, very few poems in this book were written in late 2000, early 2001. Most of them were written during the period following September 11th.
Is that typical for you, that every 5 years we have a book?
Mostly it's every 6. Once I raced for some reason into a period of great prolificness, and it was a mere 3.5. But 5 or 6 years is pretty much my pacing for a new body of work.
I was very interested to learn that you were among the first graduating class at Princeton that allowed women. And that's, you know, I have known you for 15 years maybe, and that is a very significant fact to me.
Well, you know, it was almost an accident in that I was deciding, when I decided where to go to school, between Bennington, which was a tiny girl school just starting to take men, and Princeton, a not that large boys school just starting to take women. And of course, one was a place known as being devoted to the arts, and the other not so much in those days. The terrific creative writing program at Princeton has happened since then. But I think it turned out to be a good decision for me to go to a place a little bit larger. And I ended up studying, yes, creative writing, but also taking a lot of literature and translation courses, a great many courses in the East Asian Studies Department. And that was really helpful to my future development, I think.
We will hear those tones in her poetry today. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and here's Jane with another poem.
This poem very much reflects the way the seasons work in California, in that they tend to blend into one another a great deal more than they do in the rest of the country. So its imagery is not metaphoric, but actually quite literal. Pyracantha and plum. Last autumn's chastened berries still on one tree, spring blossoms tender, hopeful, on another. The view from this window much as it was 10 years ago, 15. Yet it seems this morning a self-portrait both clearer and darker, as if while I slept, some Rembrandt or Bruegel had walked through the garden, looking hard.
If I said that your poetry might be fairy tales for adults, for philosophers, would you understand what I meant?
I've never heard it put that way before, but yes, I would. Helen Vendler once came up to me after hearing me read at an event, and she looked at me a little bemusedly and said, "Oh, you're a metaphysical poet, aren't you?"
Absolutely. And the fairy tale part comes from the stone cottages, the sheep's milk, the persimmon in a bowl, many enchanting qualities and images that, I mean, what do we know of persimmons today, really? You do. Tell me about it.
Well, I have lived with persimmon trees and eaten many of them. So, you know, to me, a persimmon is not so much a fairy tale fruit as an actual one, which, of course, if you don't let it ripen in its own particular way, which is, as one poem says, ripening by cold, they are absolutely inedible and full of quinine-like qualities. But if you do let them ripen, they are sweet and engaging.
Can you win? My associate producer is smiling because we had a bet whether you really ate persimmons or whether it was just on the page. He wins. This is Jane Hirschfield. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
Flowering Vetch. Each of the tragedies can be read as the tale of a single ripening self, each character part of one soul. The comedies can be included in this as well. Often the flaw is a flaw of self-knowledge, sometimes greed. For this reason, the comic glint of a school of herring leads to no plot line. We cannot imagine a tragedy of donkeys or bees. Before the ordinary realities, ordinary failures. Hunger, coldness, anger, longing, heat. Yet one day, a thought as small as a vetch flower opens. After, no longer minding the minor and almost wordless role, playing the messenger given the letter everyone knows will arrive too late or ruined by water. To have stopped by the fig and eaten was not an error then, but the reason for going.
And that brings me to the heart of your writing, which is about time and space, and the moment in which happiness and unhappiness are the same, everything and nothing is the same, except in the space it occupies. So that in addition to being a metaphysical poet, you are kind of a physicist. And am I correct in saying that it is one of your preoccupations that what happens in the moment is only important as to where that moment is?
I would say it is entirely the case that my poems are one moment's witness, one moment's evidence, and that a great deal of the effort of my life outside of poems as well as within them is to find my way into the presence of the present. And if you like, I have a poem about the moment, which seems like a very natural thing to move to at this moment.
We're talking to Jane Hirschfield, and we're reading from the new book, After. This is Grace Cavalieri talking, and we're going to be hearing Jane segue into our conversation. She is known throughout the country for her work. She's appeared in Best American Poetry. She's had a Pushcart Prize. She's been in the Atlantic Monthly, the New Yorker, the American Poetry Review. I have taught her essays, Nine Gates, in college classrooms, and here she is, the poet.
So this poem, which is called Instant Glimpsable Only for an Instant, shows, I think, the paradox of what it is to try to live in a moment. And it is, as many of the poems in this book are technically what you would call odes, they are addressing the thing that they are examining. Moment, moment, moment. Equal inside you, moment, the velocitous mountains and cities rising and falling, songs of children, iridescence even of beetles. It is not you the locust can strip of all leaf. Untouchable green at the center, the wolf too lopes past you and through you as he eats. Insult to mourn you, you who mourn no one, unable. Without transformation, yours the role of the chorus to whom nothing happens. The living step forward, choosing to enter, to lose. I, who am made of you only, speak these words against your unmasterable instruction. A knife cannot cut itself open, yet you ask me both to be you and to know you.
That's the poet's dilemma. I love the knife cannot cut itself open. That is, I guess, my favorite line in the whole book, so I'm so glad you read that. We look at your work and understand that many poets home in on the moment and crystallize that in time, and many more down-home poets than you do. Ted Kooser does it. But what you do additional to that is you take a refraction of the moment so that when you speak, we have another transparency. And this is what no other poet is doing. It's almost sorrow, not sorrow, peering. However, you can talk about sorrow, full frontal, but it's almost. So what you do is, I imagine you writing the poem and then taking it, kicking it up a notch, and finding a veil of the poem. It's like Cézanne writing on white and putting the colors on white. Do you know what I mean when I say you are at the edge of the moment?
Well, I do understand what you mean. Again, you know, it's very interesting when people talk to you about your work, because I don't tend to think about my work objectively. I think it through from the inside. And so a poem for me is not an act of recording something already known, but a kind of exploration and an act of discovery. It's a hunt and a search. And so what you are seeing is not so much that I've decided to look at the world in a certain way, as that when I look at the world, I find a world around me which is full of reflections, refractions, paradox. One of my theories about poetry in general is that every good poem contains something which is hidden from the reader and yet felt. Good poems contain mystery. Good poems pull in two directions. And so if you're finding that in my work, I'm pleased.
Thank God you don't think of it while you're doing it. Who knows what we would get? But you'd fall all over yourself. But there needs to be another set of eyes, I believe. And my eyes can have to see something yours could not, because you're building the invisible bridges. And it's for me to cross them and to find the other side sometime. And I never get lost in your work, I have to say that. All the mystery is there, but I never get lost. Jane Hirschfield has 5 other books. After is her 6th book. Then we have Given Sugar, Given Salt, The Lives of the Heart, The October Palace, Of Gravity and Angels, Alaya, I thought that. And the author, as I said, of a collection of essays, 9 Gates, Entering the Mind of Poetry. And we are honoring today a brand new book. Who's the publisher?
HarperCollins, who has published me since 1994. Beautifully, the books are always so happy for me to look at. Oh. And I'm very grateful to them. They've been a wonderful publisher for me.
Who chose this cover?
Well, I did, as I often do. It is about 15% of a painting by a very obscure Dutch painter, and it turns out that it had only been reproduced once ever in the rather obscure catalog that I owned, because I'd read about the show in a newspaper and mail ordered it in. It sounded so interesting. And when I was looking through my art books for a possible cover for this, I saw this little upper left-hand corner of a painting and immediately went, that's my next book cover.
Her name's Jane Hirschfield. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're together. She's a guest at Goucher College, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Here's Jane with another poem.
Well, I thought, since we have been talking about refraction and reflectedness that I would choose this poem to read. There are a number of poems in this book which carry a particular subtitle that are called an assay after whatever it is that they look at. And I take the word less from its etymological cognate, the simple word essay, and more from the its use in the chemistry and mining industries, where if you want to know what something is, you assay it, which means you find out what are its component parts, what are their relative strengths. So, for example, during the gold rush, if you found a little nugget that you thought was rich in gold, you would take it to the assayer's office, who would determine exactly its components. Mm. So these poems are a bit essay-like in that their tone is slightly over towards prose from some of my other lyrics. They have a considering quality to them, and that's what they're doing. They're meditations upon and considerations of what they look at in order to bring poetic mind to the dismantling of something into a greater visibility and a deepened knowledge. So this one is looking at the idea of articulation, which of course is a word which both means eloquence and jointedness. Articulation, an essay. A good argument, etymology instructs, is many-jointed. By this measure, the most expressive of beings must be the giraffe. Yet the speaking tongue is supple, untroubled by bone. What would it be to take up no position, to lie on this earth at rest, relieved of proof or change? Scent of thyme or grass amid the scent of many herbs and grasses. Grief unresisted as granite darkened by rain. Continuous praises most glad, placed against nothing. But thought is hinge and swerve, is winch, is folding. Reflection, we call the mountain in the lake, whose existence resides in neither stone nor water.
I looked up assay to see what it was connected, how it was connected to essay, and I saw that it said considering, to consider. And so you use your titles many times as more than signpost; they become part of the poem. And in your, how many assays do you have? You have quite a few in this book.
I've never counted.
Oh, I bet 20, at least, yeah.
And there's also at least an astute friend of mine after reading the book came up to me and said, now, Jane, you know, isn't to speech also an assay? And isn't, so she caught, there are poems in the book which are not sublabeled assay, and yet they still are assays, and she recognized the tone and nailed it.
But what a nice way to organize the book, because that really focused it. And I thought that is very clever. What light bulb went off that just made you think essay?
Well, what happened was I wrote the first of these poems, which I don't think I'll read on this program, but it's a poem examining Edgar Allan Poe. And I had actually written about him in an essay a couple of years before, and not all of my thoughts had made it into the finished essay because he was being used as an example. The essay was about the subject of poetry and the hidden. And it seemed that my psyche was not quite done with him. So I wrote the poem, but it had this very unusual sort of thinky, considering tone to it. And when I was looking to title it, I thought, now what title would fit this poem? And what I came up with was Poe, an essay. Mm-hmm. And then I thought it was, you know, that something I was going to do once. But what seemed to happen was I was magnetically drawn to this particular way of poem making, which I had never quite done before. This particular voice, this particular, you know, looking in a multifaceted way at a subject and not necessarily putting every single connection in. And so I began to write other poems in the same tone. The next one I wrote was the poem To Judgment. And once you have two poems called an essay, well, then you have a possible series.
And the way you look at things we could call point of view, and your point of view is prismatic, even to the point of at some time taking the point of view of a blind fish. You've even taken the point of view of a blind fish. Now that takes an imagination that cannot be taught.
But isn't this exactly what poetry does? I mean, I believe that one of the reasons that human beings need poems in their lives is because it expands our knowledge far beyond the point of view of the narrow ego, the managing self, and allows us to participate in the world from the point of view of all of existence. Every time a poet uses an image, it is a portrait of a state of soul. Every time a poet uses a metaphor, they are not only learning how a mountain might inform our own understanding of our own lives, but also how our lives can help us understand the point of view, if you'll have it, of a mountain.
And I must add, the blind fish became luminescent in the poem, so his lot wasn't a failure at all. Here's another poem from Jane Hirschfield.
Dog and Bear. The air this morning, blowing between fog and drizzle, is like a white dog in the snow who scents a white bear in the snow who is not there. Deeper than seeing, deeper than hearing, they stand and glare, one at the other. So many listen, lost, in every weather. The mind has mountains, Hopkins wrote, against his sadness. The dog held the bear at bay that day.
I won't ask you to find it, but there is a poem about the mountain, and as you climb up the mountain, your view is very different. And that was, is that one of the pebbles?
No, but that's a poem I had been intending to read anyhow, so why don't we hear it? One of the things about this poem is it strikes me as the product of one of the gifts of poetry, which is often a poem will come to you from something which has happened to you, but equally a poem can come from something which hasn't happened. So this poem, its genesis was in a trip to Lithuania, which did not, in fact, happen, and yet the poem came out of it nonetheless. Vilnius. For a long time, I keep the guidebooks out on the table. In the morning, drinking coffee, I see the spines. St. Petersburg, Vilnius, Vienna. Choices pondered, but not finally taken. Behind them, sometimes behind thick fog, the mountain. If you lived higher up on the mountain, I find myself thinking, what you would see is more of everything else, but not the mountain.
That is terrific. That is quintessential Jane Hirschfield. It has all of your personality in those eight maybe short lines. Might as well tell a few more things about her because she's too modest to do it herself. She has edited and co-translated collections Women in Praise of the Sacred, 43 Centuries of Spiritual Poetry by Women, The Ink, Dark Moon, Love Poems by, will you tell me, is it Komachi?
Yes.
Ono Komachi. And give me the other Japanese name.
The two of them are Ono no Komachi and Izumi Shikibu.
Women of the Ancient Court of Japan and Mirabai. Ecstatic poems. Tell us what that means.
Well, that title, that particular book of Mirabai versions, as we would call it, was done together with Robert Bly at his publisher's request. Basically, Beacon loved the Kabir book and wanted another one with a woman poet, and so we did. Each of us had translated some work by Mirabai previously, and Robert called me up and asked me if I would join him in this book. So ecstatic poems simply means Mirabai was a wild mystic, and her poems reflect that.
And Robert Bly loves you. Here's what he says. There is something subtle and new in Jane Hirschfield's poems. She has absorbed the vertical line through her discipline, and it gives her poems an intensity that doesn't kill ordinary life. He goes on, but I wish to amend that by saying the vertical line in our lives is the light. The horizontal line is the step-by-step from birth to grave, but the vertical is the light. And that's what we're talking about today, how poetry captures light and how you have made that possible for us. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're interviewing Jane Hirschfield. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.